Well, when we look back through history on 2019, nobody's going to claim that this was a vintage year. It's probably best not to get into politics in an election week, but it would be fair to say that whoever you support, no one has really covered themselves in glory in last year's politics. And it's hard to know what to even ask our politicians to do, isn't it? Because our political system and our culture, our society seems so fractured. There are huge numbers of people right now, children living in poverty in the town which I work in, Luton. In Luton, over 50% of children are living beneath the poverty line. In Luton, in England. There are huge problems too with racism and with homophobia and with gender injustice and other kinds of bigotry and prejudice. And they seem to be getting worse, not better. Issues like anti-Semitism are back in the spotlight. That is unthinkable. And we come to terms with the scale of our environmental crisis, and we still can't figure out how to leave the EU. It's not been a vintage year, but I feel like I'm really depressed. 2019 was not all bad, because 2019 was also the year that Avengers Endgame came out. You may not care about that at all, but I'm a youth worker, and this is the youth service, and so we don't care. This was the second of two Avengers movies, featuring Thanos, a mad alien, intent on wiping out half of the entire universe. This is him. He's a monster, but he's not a madman. He's got a very clear ideology behind his plan. He wants to kill half of all life so that the other half can thrive. It's a kind of extreme population control. Now, Avengers Endgame is the second part of one big story. The first half was Avengers Infinity War. And the first film is remarkable, and I know many of you may find it difficult to find superhero films remarkable, but it's remarkable because we basically follow the villain around, and that in filmmaking terms is a bit of a no-no. It breaks the mold. We follow the villain around rather than the heroes. And there's a reason for that. Because sometimes to truly see the light, and we do at the end of the second film, to truly see the light, you have to look first at the darkness. And so this evening, it being a carol service, you might imagine we're going to look at Jesus, the glorious light of the world, the reason for the season, and we are, but not yet. First, we're going to look at the darkness. So tonight we're going to look at someone who usually gets overlooked at Christmas. He gets left out of most school nativities. If you come home and tell your parents you're playing him, they're somewhat disappointed and worried about what the teachers are getting at. He's remembered as one of history's most appalling leaders. Merry Christmas, we're going to look at King Herod. We heard Joel and Joe read the story of the visit of the Magi just now. That's Herod the Great's main appearance in the Bible. Don't confuse him with the other Herod that we see later on when Jesus is crucified. This King Herod was the puppet ruler of Judea, leading up to the time of Jesus' birth. And he was a Jew who ultimately served Roman masters. And he was known for his excesses in every direction. So he was famous for colossal building projects across Jerusalem. But he also oversaw the establishment of an aristocracy and a class system which elevated some but left others in poverty. And here's the thing we need to know about King Herod. He is a power guy. His ideology was about building and expanding and growing. And as long as you were on the inside of his circle, that was good for you. You benefited from his power. The problem was if you were on the outside of Herod's circle, then his power worked against you. And if I may, I'm going to find one more parallel with Thanos there. Because if you're in the right half of the universe, Thanos ends up being a kind of good news for you. Everything thrives. It was the same with Herod. So Herod rules over Judea. And in fact, when we meet him, he's at the very end of his life and rule. And therefore, he's probably in declining health. And he's probably feeling a lot less invincible than he used to. And he's paranoid that someone might come along and replace him. He's paranoid even about his own sons. And then these wise men appear from the east. They're astrologers who have literally seen something written in the stars. And it's something which is devastating for Herod, because they ask in verse 2, where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. And that gets back to Herod fast. It becomes the talk of the town. And what's more, verse 3 says, when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. So Herod hears this and he's immediately disturbed. He's panicked even. A new king of the Jews has been born. And while that might be good news for some, that's pretty grave implications for the current king of the Jews. Because the Magi don't say that they've come to visit the one who's been born, who's going to grow up one day to become king of the Jews. They say, the one who has been born king of the Jews. And Herod hears that, he hears takeover, he hears coup, he hears being usurped and overthrown as a power guy. It's not just that a pretender to his throne has appeared on Herod's horizon, he's arrived, he's here now. Herod is a Jew, his family were Jewish converts, but for him this isn't great news. There's no thought that this might be the promised Messiah that his religion talks about. This isn't hope. To Herod, this is disturbing. I'm a king who sits on his own throne in his own home. With all I own, it's all I've done, and it's all I've known. I've been raised for the taste of empty praise from a pleasing face, yearning for something to fill this empty space, this void, this hole that burns within my heart. And yet, no words have succeeded, for none of what I needed, frustrated, defeated, never feeling completed. Within me is a sea of anxiety, waves of uncertainty, chains of insecurity, but I cannot allow that to sink. For I am king, I am royalty. So when I hear of a child whose very existence threatens the throne I sit upon, you better get angry. You better get mad. No child is going to get his hands on what I have. I'm not going to let him do what he pleases. Go out and find me, Jesus. Bring him back to me so I can have him killed. I don't care what he has said or what he has willed, whatever prophecy he's come to fulfill. Go out and find me, Jesus. Why am I so frightened? Why am I insecurity so heightened? Why does it feel like the world I've created has begun to tighten? I am a titan, a force to be reckoned. So why have I beckoned my guards to bring me this child, seemingly so weak and so mild? Because it is true. When I stand in his presence, he stands to ruin my very existence. Because I'll have to admit that all these possessions, all the glitz and the glamour and processions in honor of me have power over me, and I am not willing to let them slip away from me. Go out and do whatever it takes. Leave no room for mistakes. The stakes are already way too high. Go out and find me, Jesus. Herod is seriously disturbed. Yet it's not just him who's disturbed. All Jerusalem is disturbed with him. Now, what do we think that really means in Herod's world of power and inequality? Is it literally everyone in Jerusalem? Or is it the ruling class? Is it everyone who is part of Herod's kingdom? Everyone who benefits from being a part of his reign? I think those are the people who would be disturbed by this news. The thought that a new king might come in and replace Herod. One who came from outside their network. One they couldn't control. What if this king were to decide that they were outside his circle? Where would they be then? It's easy to make Herod the villain because to some extent he is. But it's more than just one man. Herod is the figurehead of an entire system of inequality and oppression. And when the new king is born, he doesn't just threaten Herod, he threatens the whole system. Anyway, back to the story. The Magi are floating around Jerusalem and Herod summons them. Verse 8 says, he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. And as soon as you find him, report to me, so that I may go and worship him. Now this is the sort of scene that really deserves some kind of incidental music, right? Because Herod is being anything but straightforward at this point. He's got no intention of bowing the knee to worship this child. He knows his best chance of self-preservation is to kill the new king when he's still too young to defend himself. But he claims that his motivations are pure. He says he wants to worship when really he wants to kill. He wants to co-opt faith in this child in order to destroy him. Just imagine the leader of a nation feeling threatened in his quest for power, claiming and co-opting faith in Jesus in order to preserve his position. Could that happen today? Anyway, Jesus feels like very bad news to Herod. But he's not bad news for everyone. And he's not actually bad news for anyone. Certainly not all Jerusalem. For the people living on the wrong side of a broken system, this new king is not bad news. For the slaves, for the working class, for the women, for all those cast out of society because they're still in need of some kind of healing, this new king is not bad news at all. The powerful are scared, but to the weak, he represents hope. And here's something really important. To some of the wealthy and powerful, he represents hope too. The Magi turn up at Jesus' house and bow before him. They actually do want to worship him. They actually do recognize his kingship. These are powerful people in fine robes with riches and treasures. And you've seen the Christmas cards. They've got loads of camels and stuff. They reckon, even though they're in that ruling class, even though they are part of the power set, they recognize his kingship. In fact, they do two things. First, he's a small child, and they bow to him. And that would have looked pretty ridiculous. They would have had to get pretty low in order to bow to a small child. If you bow before an adult king, you bend the knee or you bow at the waist. But to bow to an infant, you actually pretty much have to lie prostrate on the ground. Now, if you are a wise man in all this finery with your train of servants and all your riches, you're making yourself look pretty foolish by actually coming before Jesus. Not just kneeling, but getting right down on your face. But I think that's what they do. They've had to make themselves look really foolish. They have to throw off all the pomp and circumstance of their social class, but it's worth it because they recognize who he is, and that's what that means. And secondly, we all know this bit. Anybody who's been in the Nativity knows this bit. They give him their treasure. But it's not just nice gifts. It's not the parcels you see in Nativity plays. The scripture actually says, they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, I'm speculating a little bit here, but it seems to me that they actually went to their own possessions, to their own treasures, and they gave Jesus from their best stuff. They probably gave until it hurt. This wasn't a thoughtless gift voucher that you pick up at Morrison's on Christmas Eve. You have all done it. This is gifts from their own treasures. When you open your treasures, you're actually opening your heart. Later on, when you can speak, Jesus says that where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. When you give someone your treasure, you are pledging allegiance to them. So what is happening in both of these acts? I think there's a transfer of power going on. The powerful surrendering their status and their stuff to recognize Jesus as king. So two very different reactions to Jesus, both saying they come to worship. But one seeking to subvert and destroy, and the other seeking to submit and worship. So the wise men provide us with this really stark contrast to King Herod. That tragedy is not the end of Herod's story. The Magi slip away and never return to Herod, and they're warned in a dream not to see him again. You probably know what happens next. An angel warns Joseph to pack up and leave in the night because evil is coming for them. And he and Mary take Jesus and they leave for Egypt. And then one of the most awful atrocities recorded in the Bible takes place. Matthew 2 verse 16 says this: when Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. The powerful king feels foolish. He feels humbled, but it's not the same as when the wise men humbled themselves. He unleashes his fury unthinkably. He orders that every infant in Bethlehem be killed, and they are. And historians estimate that Herod's soldiers murdered between 12 and 15 tiny children. It is indefensible. It is horrific. You might describe it as evil seen in its purest form. And actually, Herod's story has no redemption to it. He dies a few years later of an agonizing, undiagnosable disease that those around him nickname Herod's evil. And when he does that, Jesus returns to Judea. 30 years later, this child is now a grown man. And his coronation happens on a barbaric cross. And he's killed with a crown of thorns on his head. And a sign above him, what does the sign read? This is the King of the Jews.
Majesty in this baby. I meet Jesus, I choose Jesus. If I meet Jesus, I meet Jesus, I choose Jesus.
Place it with a revolution of love. And that all sounds great unless you happen to be the one being overthrown. Perhaps that's why the powerful have been trying to suppress and discredit and overthrow and kill off Jesus ever since the events of this story first took place. It's why Christians are persecuted all over the world. It's why there are campaigns to keep faith out of education and politics, is perhaps even why we have such a sanitized, commercialized version of Christmas. Jesus rose from the tomb, and powerful people have been trying to bury him ever since. So as we think about this story of Herod and the Magi and Jesus 2,000 years later, who is who? You can relax. I am not about to suggest that any single person has taken over the mantle of King Herod. But I do wonder if the broader legacy of Herod's kingdom has been inherited. Because in this world, you are either on one side of the line or the other. If you have enough money, if you know the right people, if you live in the right place, and let's be honest, we absolutely do live in the right place, then you are going to be fine. You're on the inside of the circle. If Herod were here today, he would probably invite me to his parties. But not everyone. Remember at the start I talked about the poverty line in Luton? Do you know there are actually 10 constituencies in the UK where child poverty is above 50%? Children and young people not having enough to eat, not in far-off Ethiopia, but in Peterborough and Tower Hamlets and Blackburn, do you know there are now more food banks in the UK than there are McDonald's? Climate change is a serious issue, but it's even more serious when you are on the wrong side of the line, if you are living in one of the countries that's been identified most at risk from climate change, from the change in sea level like Haiti or the Philippines or Bangladesh. If you live there, you are outside the circle in the most terrifying, depressing way. And there are still many places where if you are born black or Jewish or Arab or a woman, then you are on the wrong side of the circle. And these places aren't always far away. This also was in Luton. I don't think Herod is a person today, but Herod's kingdom is alive and well. And here is the big news that we are here to share at Christmas. The whole reason we're here this evening, the whole reason we do this whole thing, this baby, this king, is born to overthrow it. So let's get back to that question. Who are we in this story about Herod the Magi and Jesus? Well, if like me, you're living very much on the inside of Herod's circle, you're probably feeling slightly panicked at this point. But thank goodness for the Magi. They are wealthy, they are powerful, they are privileged like us, like me. But when they see Jesus, they do those things. They bow before him, they pledge allegiance to him, they let him into their hearts, they recognize him as king. And they defy the kingdom of the world around them. They choose to use some of their power to give up their power. You've probably worked out by now why we call this service Find Me Jesus. Because it's Herod's call, desperate, panicked, find me Jesus, get me Jesus, so that I can co-opt him and then suffocate him. Sometimes our culture does that too. It is taking Christmas and burying it so deep in wrapping paper and John Lewis Christmas adverts that the original Jesus is barely visible. But finally, Jesus is also the call of those wise men, the Magi, the powerful, privileged people in a Herod world who are desperate to find the real king. Not so they can destroy him, but so they can join his revolution. They are people who know that all is not right with the world. They are people who want to be part of a movement to renew it. So this evening, friends, which are you? Are you happy with the state of the world? Are you comfortable with your position in it? Or do you long to see renewal and redemption? Are you tired of gazing into the darkness? Because if that's you, then Jesus is the light you're looking for. Because this child isn't just a revolutionary. He's the Son of God, sent by his Father to repair the way between heaven and earth. And he comes and he dies to save us from sin, which is a difficult word. But sin isn't really about that lie that you told to your boss last week. It isn't really about that time the other day when you got your sister in a headlock. Joel. It is about those things. But those personal mistakes that we make are only signs of the much bigger problem. Sin isn't just a few people breaking rules. It is a system breaking the world. It is the kingdom of Herod and every corrupt leader before and after him. And Jesus' birth, death, and resurrection 2,000 years ago break the power of that system forever. This king, this baby, begins the process of setting the world right again. And if there are still any big Avengers Endgame fans awake, it's that moment when the Hulk clicks his fingers. That was a massive spoiler, sorry, I haven't seen it. So by recognizing him, by bowing the knee to him, we join his kingdom. We become part of that revolution against sin, part of that revolution to bring hope to a broken world. I'm not going to ask us in response to bow, and you'll be grateful to know that I'm not going to ask us to lie prostrate. But if you're able, I'd love you to join me in recognizing him as king in this moment. And in a moment, I'd like to invite you to stand, if you're able, with me. And we'll just spend a moment recognizing him as king together in here before we recognize him as king out there, quite literally. So if Jesus is your king, or if you think you'd like him to be, would you please stand with me now? And let's pray. Jesus, we recognize you as our King. You are the light of the world. You are come to renew and remake it. And you choose to use us in that as your hands and feet, Lord. We want to join and be part of your revolution. We want to serve you. We submit our lives and ourselves and everything we are for you. We thank you for this story, this picture of you as a baby coming to the world vulnerable, servant. Lord, would we somehow take on the mantle of following in your footsteps and becoming a servant to the world. Use us, Lord, this Christmas and always through our lives to renew and remake our world.